From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. A Southern doctor was the first to treat female medical problems.
Now we think of him as the nation's father of American gynecology. But on what was his laurels predicated? It was predicated on the savage abuse of enslaved women.
We'll look at the somewhat ugly origins of gynecology in the U.S. today. First, though, we talked last week with R.E.M. bassist Mike Mills. R.E.M.'s hit album Automatic for the People is getting a 25th anniversary re-release.
A lot of the things about the South get badly stereotyped, and you know, people tend to focus on some of the more negative aspects of it. So we were really happy to present Southernness and Southerners as something, you know, unique and interesting and intelligent.
We asked what your favorite R.E.M. songs or albums are, and here are your first thoughts. This is Wilson from Dahlonega, who says his favorite R.E.M. song is What's the Frequency, Kenneth?
Mainly because of the absolutely bizarre backstory to it. It was all about Dan Rather's assault in the 80s. Two men assaulted Dan Rather, and one of them kept on screaming over and over, "What's the frequency, Kenneth? What's the frequency, Kenneth?" And that just sums R.E.M. up in a nutshell to me. They just can take something so deliciously unique and turn it into a banger of a song.
We also asked what albums stand the test of time for you. So here's Ed Hall.
I know I'm not alone in my estimation that the self-titled Pretender's first album is a perfect thing, musically speaking. That record never gets old, it never gets tired, and I never get tired of listening to it.
GPB's Grant Blankenship recommends Built to Spill's Perfect From Now On, and Naman Gibbets on Twitter is a fan of R.E.M.'s Life's Rich Pageant. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. So here's the good news. Breast cancer death rates dropped by almost 40% over the past three decades. Breast cancer is still the second most common cancer diagnosis for U.S. women. Skin cancer is first. But there is bad news in this new data. Black women continue to die at a higher rate than whites, especially here in the South. These are recent findings from the Atlanta-based American Cancer Society. Carol DeSantis is Director of Breast and Gynecological Surveillance for that organization. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's kind of get a couple general things out of the way before we dig into what you found in the latest survey. Even though we're talking about the fact that fewer women are dying of breast cancer, it's still very dangerous and women need to get checked.
That's true, yes. It's still, mammography is the best way we have of detecting breast cancer early. So it is important for women to be screened regularly.
So then let's dig into these particular things, because it looks as though the disparity between the races, in other words, the disparity between the number of black women dying of breast cancer versus their white compatriots is higher here in Georgia than the average. Do we have any idea why?
So what we found is that in Georgia, the death rates for black women are about 1.5 times higher than the breast cancer death rate
That's
for white
huge.
Women.
That is a huge disparity.
It is a huge disparity. Overall in the U.S., actually, death rates are about 39% higher in black women. And then in some states, death rates are actually approximately equal.
We're going to get into those states in a little bit, but
okay.
Let's go back to this question of Georgia and whether we have been able to connect the dots to sort of draw a line between these death rates and what causes the disparities.
So the disparities largely reflect differences in access to quality and timely treatment and screening. So it's really an access to care issue.
I want to sort of drill down on what you just said. So one of them is the fact that it's so important to catch breast cancer early, and that makes such a difference to whether a woman will survive a breast cancer or not. That's accurate?
Yes.
And the other one, when you're talking about access, that also refers to how often a woman has actually gets a mammography screening, whether she gets it every year, and some of the other tests that may follow if there's any kind of inconsistent finding, right?
Right. So it's follow-up after an abnormal mammogram to get additional tests if those are needed. And to do that in a timely manner, there's research to say that black women are less likely to follow up and to do so in a timely manner after an abnormal mammogram.
But do we have any idea whether it's access to doctors and centers, or whether it's access to insurance?
I think both of those certainly play a role. So, you know, access to insurance allows you access, just having insurance, you don't necessarily have access to medical
right.
care. So there are other barriers as well. You know, depending on your job, if you have time off to do screening or to get treatment if you're diagnosed, I mean, there are a number of barriers. And it's really a largely reflects socioeconomic issues as well.
And we've been talking on this show a lot about the fact that in rural Georgia, especially in rural areas, sometimes you can go quite a long distance before you reach a clinician, a GP, or a hospital. So that can also be a problem, especially if not only do you not get time off, but in order to go, you'd have to take hours out of your day to get to a clinic, which complicates all of this.
Right.
So then let's then talk about Massachusetts and Delaware. And you guys found, was this the first time that you'd found these two states had sort of basically eliminated the disparity?
Yeah, this was our first report that really we noted that these states have the risk of breast cancer death was essentially the same in black and white women, because we'd known that overall in the U.S. that the risk was much higher for black women. So it was really interesting to see that the health equity would be possible that in these
right.
states.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Carol DeSantis, Director of Breast and Gynecological Cancer Surveillance for the American Cancer Society. So let me ask you the same question here. Have we connected the dots? Do we know what's going right in Massachusetts and Delaware?
Well, we know, for example, in Delaware, what they did was back in 2003, they had a concerted effort to reduce disparities in colorectal cancer. That was their focus. And so they had they addressed issues related to insurance, patient education, patient navigation, and it had been noted that they were able to eliminate racial disparities in colorectal cancer. To my knowledge, I don't know of the research that anyone else has looked at to see if the breast cancer disparities had been eliminated. But now we see that the breast cancer death rate was essentially very similar in black and white women.
And it could have been just sort of a trailing indicator from eliminating the colorectal cancer disparities.
Right. The issues are very similar.
Yeah.
They are essentially the same.
By tackling the disparities in this one cancer, it also had possibly great benefits in another type of very deadly cancer.
Exactly.
Now, I actually mentioned to somebody in Starbucks yesterday that I was going to be talking about this today. Don't ask me how it came up. But she says to me, you know, I never know what to believe anyway, because I thought that mammograms they don't even detect cancer. So I've stopped getting them.
Oh, goodness.
Yes. So, and there have been reports that mammograms aren't as effective at detecting tumors as many people had assumed. How do you answer that concern?
Well, we're having honest conversations now that mammography isn't perfect. It does have its limitations. Sometimes it misses breast cancer. Sometimes it might detect a cancer that would not have eventually become fatal or even become known without mammography. But it is truly our best way of detecting breast cancer early. So it's extremely important for women to be screened with mammography in order to, you know, increase their chances that a breast cancer could be detected at the earliest stage possible.
So how would you say, how much improvement have we made in a woman's ability to survive breast cancer if she is getting her regular screenings? If she's going in once a year, are the chances gone up significantly?
Yes. So survival for breast cancer detected at the local stage, the earliest stage, are, you know, 95% to 99%. You know, it's very, very
Holy
high.
Holy cow.
Yes.
And that's within a year's time.
That's over 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy cow. So that's kind of amazing. And that at this point, as you mentioned, mammography, but there's also the self-check as well. Is the self-check relatively effective, or are your average person like myself not that great at detecting changes in our own tissue?
So that's the thing. The American Cancer Society no longer recommends that women do monthly self-exams, but they do absolutely recommend that women are aware of their breasts. If they notice any kind of persistent change, they should certainly let their doctors know. But the research didn't support doing a monthly breast self-exam. But certainly, if you notice some kind of, you know, unusual change in your breast, you should alert your doctor.
So let's go back to these disparities. And I wonder how concerned you are about some of the turmoil that's been going on in the health insurance market, the fact that there's so much uncertainty related to what's happening in D.C. and how that may affect, possibly worsen some of the disparities that we're talking about.
It's extremely concerning. My group has done, some initial studies after the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, showing that there's been an increase in breast cancers diagnosed at an early stage, and so to think that could potentially be rolled back
because millions more people got insurance.
Yes, because more people. Yes, totally. So they compared women in states that had expanded the Medicaid program so that more people were able to get insurance versus states that didn't. And they were able to show that the states that expanded insurance to more women, that breast cancers were being detected earlier. I mean, we only have very preliminary data, so it will need more follow-up to see. But that's what's looking like is potentially happening. So on the flip side, to think that and there's a huge body of literature and research to support that insurance is very important for getting access to screening and, all of this. So certainly with the potential of women not having access to insurance or not having insurance, it's very concerning that breast cancer won't be detected early and that women, not just detected early, but they wouldn't have access to treatment and more women could die.
Yeah, which suggests women will go and get checked if it's just a simple copay as opposed to paying for an entire mammogram themselves.
Right.
So in the last 2 minutes that we have, since people are driving around and seeing pink water fountains and pink ribbons everywhere, how much has the increase in funding and attention to breast cancer over the past, say, 20 years, how much has that affected the numbers you were talking about, the very encouraging numbers you were talking about earlier, about how your survival rates, has that actually resulted in research that has affected survival?
So breast cancer death rates, we were saying, have dropped since 1989 by nearly 40%. So, I mean, over that past 3.5 decades, there's been remarkable progress in breast cancer treatments. And so certainly there's been, new treatments, the introduction of tamoxifen, which was back in the 1980s, and now we have these targeted therapies for breast cancer.
So maybe there's been an effect from all those pink water bottles that people buy, or we don't know.
I don't know if that's right.
She is not going to draw the line between the pink sugar cookie that you just bought at Starbucks. That's Carol DeSantis. She is the Director of Breast and Gynecological Cancer Surveillance for the American Cancer Society, the lead author on a long-running study of breast cancer statistics in the U.S. that has both good news and bad news, though I will say, go get screened.
Yes, definitely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, rats. We're going to talk about rodent woes in the Peach State. First, though, a troubled history of gynecology here in the South. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Modern gynecology in the U.S. was largely born in the antebellum South. That's because some of the country's first gynecologists conducted their experiments on enslaved women. That history is explored in a new book that's called Medical Bondage, Race, Gender, and the Origins of American Gynecology. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. Author Deirdre Cooper Owens is an assistant professor at Queens College in New York. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You know, it's interesting that this book, and I'm sure considering how well researched it is, that you started work on this book quite some time ago. But this is a topic that has come up, especially because of the statue in New York that women are protesting that they bring down, which is a statue of a man who did many of the things that you describe in your book, that he studied gynecology by experimenting on mostly enslaved women. Why do you think this topic is coming up now?
It's coming up in light of the contentious history, but also political issue of the Confederate statue removal. And so it's interesting for me as a historian of medicine and race and slavery that calls for James Marion Sims's statue to be removed has really recycled itself about every 8 to 10 years. So when I finished my dissertation in 2008, I remember with the publication of two other books by Harriet Washington and Marie Jenkins Schwartz that there had been some really pointed demands by a lot of activists to have his statue removed. But I think it's being taken much more seriously in the mainstream media and also by other Americans because it stands in the light of the Confederate statue removal that's going on so many different places throughout the South and the Northeast.
And I also actually read a commentary coming out of New York that they feel one of the reasons the issue is being taken more seriously is because white women have joined in the protest, whereas oftentimes, largely, it was African-American women protesting before. What do you make of that argument?
You know, it certainly would probably be true, as a student and a teacher of American history. Typically, when you have members of white communities join in solidarity with people of color, those protests are often and demands are often taken much more seriously. They're given a bit more credence. I know in New York, the issue is still in the air. You know, the Parks Commission in the city hasn't really made any statements about the statue staying or being removed. I think a couple of years ago, there had been some updates about possibly recontextualizing the commemorative plaque on the statue in Central Park.
Yeah.
But in all honesty, those folk I know who are working on the issue are really just waiting. And it seems as if the New York City Parks Commission is unfortunately silent on this issue that's so timely for others.
Yeah, and before we get down south, let's talk one more time about James Marion Sims and the effort to remove the statue on Fifth Avenue. He actually founded the country's first women's hospital there. That was in the 1850s. Here's Harriet Washington. She's author of Medical Apartheid, and she's speaking at a community forum in Harlem from earlier this year.
These women were rendered unfit for work by their horrible condition, a condition which Dr. Sims ascribed to their being black women who were sexually profligate because all black women were viewed that way, and who were dirty because black people were viewed that way, and who were result of their practices.
I wonder what kind of resonance you find there, that description of how they were treated up north in New York, with the studies that you did into what was happening in the South.
Okay, so it's interesting. So with Sims, I always correct this statement, and it literally starts my book. The first slave hospital that was founded for women was actually founded in Alabama by James Marion Sims, and he states this in his memoirs and also in his other writings and speeches. And so he begins work on enslaved women in Alabama. Once he relocates to New York City, he begins working on a more diverse patient body, but largely those who are coming in are poor, and many are recently arrived immigrants. So the first patient that he serves at this hospital in New York is Mary Smith, who is an Irish immigrant who had recently come to the United States not long before. And so there is a very much a way that black people, the enslaved especially, have been viewed in American society, particularly in the 18th and 19th century with the rise of racial science and all ideas about black people being vectors for disease. And then you can see that same kind of mapping of blackness, I call it, being placed on the bodies of another, you know, quote unquote, degraded group of women who would be poor Irish immigrant women who were treated almost similarly by James Marion Sims. And so, you know, I totally agree with Harriet Washington's stance, but I also tell people to think about contextualizing the social world of the antebellum South. How else would Sims or any of his peers have known to treat black women and to treat slaves?
So let's
right? these were people.
Yeah, let me play you a comment from Dr. Janice Coleman. And she's, again, mm-hmm. speaking about Marion Sims. She's an OBGYN in Columbia, South Carolina. Here's her first yes. comment.
You have to put it in the context of when he was practicing. This is the mid-1800s, the 19th century. Slavery was in existence. All of his early work, pioneering work, was done on slaves.
And then you have this comment from Judith Burgess, who's the chair of obstetrics and gynecology at the Med School for the University of South Carolina. That is where Marion Sims was from. And she, it sounds like she's trying to say he wasn't a complete villain.
Dr. James Marion Sims was innovative, he was caring, and he tried to make the lives better for all the patients that he encountered.
How do you respond to that?
So, yeah. So it's also interesting the way the music was playing in the background, right?
It is a little,
James
yeah.
Marion Sims was a 19th century slave-owning physician. And in his autobiography, he describes Black people using the racial epithets of the day, you know, calling them the N-words. He cared no more about those enslaved women's lives than any other slave owner. What he did was he entered into a legal contract with their owners. And so his relationship was not to Anarka Betsy Lucy and the other unidentified women who he experimented on, but it was with their owners who leased these women's sick bodies to Dr. Sims for him to, in his words, repair or fix. And so to paint a man who owned human beings as property, as some benevolent martyr, I think, you know, is the worst kind of revisionist history. And I use this as someone who is, you know, stands by the label as a revisionist history, because a lot of the history about enslaved people were that they were happy darkies, content with content with their status and their state. And that's simply not the case. James Marion Sims was a doctor who cared about repairing these women so that they would be, in his words, fit for the duties of their bondage.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Deirdre Cooper Owens. Her book comes out today. It's called Medical Bondage, Race, Gender, and the Origins of American Gynecology. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. So congratulations. It's your book day.
Thank you.
I have been sort of staying away from some of the descriptions of what happened to these women because it's very tough. And he often was experimenting on them without any kind of anesthesia or pain control. This is probably a dumb question, but why?
Because he started to experiment on them in the 1840s, 1844, and he lived in a rural community, Mount Meigs, Alabama, which was about 15 miles outside of Montgomery. James Marion Sims came from the old school, so to speak. And so this was a man who prided himself on his dexterity in terms of surgical repair. And also it was expedient for him to have patients awake. So a part of the positioning of James Marion Sims is that he was either a martyr or either a villain. And so what I'm trying to offer with the research I've done and the book that I've written is that human beings are much more complex than that. And James Marion Sims was much more complex than the kind of binary positioning that we in the 21st century are trying to place him into. And so this was a man who routinely did not use pain numbing medications or anesthetics for his patients because he wanted to get in, repair it, and be done quickly. A large part of his pride in not giving these women anesthesia during surgery was that he did not want the patients to bleed out. And that was a real possibility with any surgery that was taking place in the 19th century. Also, when he goes to New York about 7 years or so later, 5 or 7 years later, he also doesn't utilize anesthesia on the poorer white patients as well. So there is also a belief that many doctors had that the racial science of the late 18th century and 19th century supported was that certain kinds of bodies, namely Black bodies, did not experience pain. And there was also a belief that Black women really women of African descent all over the globe did not experience pain. And when they did, it was a slight pain. Right.
Yeah, and this came up, since you're a medical historian, this came up again with black soldiers that were treated during the Civil War as well, that
exactly.
There was a continuing view that African-Americans didn't need anesthesia.
Right. And what's interesting for me when I speak to audiences who are, you know, outside of academia, and I like to put the past in conversation with the present, is to point them to studies that have come out, not in 1804 or 1914 or even 1974, but in studies that have come out in the 21st century. In 2014, University of Virginia medical students still believed there were distinct biologically based differences in how black and white people experienced pain, or in the case of black people, did not experience pain. And so a large part of my mission with this book is obviously to reveal the deep linkages that the American institution of slavery had on so many different professions, but also to let them know that there are the lingering effects of this kind of medical racism that we've not quite erased from our medical training in terms of curriculum, but also in the ways that some of these students who are graduating from some of the top schools, you know, are believing these biologically distinct fictions about black and white people in particular.
And you make the argument, we only have about a minute left, but you do make the argument that some of that bias lingers, right?
Yes, it does. It does. And so, you know, if I can change someone like the last OBGYN to perhaps reconsider this hagiographic or, you know, uncritical view of these doctors because of the important work they did. And James Marion Sims did ultimately repair these women's bodies,
yeah.
And they were fertile again and able to bear children. And so we can't forget that. But to not necessarily pay him homage as the father of American gynecology when James Marion Sims states that in the last two and a half years of his experimental surgeries, he had to train his enslaved patients to also work as nurses. And
yeah.
So I need to have the American public also speak about these women in a very literal sense as the mothers
right.
of gynecology, because they were as much his surgical assistants as
yeah.
any of the other apprentices that he trained
Alabama. That's Deirdre Cooper Owen. She's assistant professor of history at Queens College. Her latest book, Medical Bondage, hits shelves today, published by the University of Georgia Press. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Atlanta Public Schools may institute a dress code to ban clothing considered distracting by school officials. At Monday night's Board of Education meeting, two fifth-grade girls appeared to say the language of the code unfairly targets them and not boys. They both wore leggings, which would be against the proposed rules. Ruby Siegerman is 10 and a student at Springdale Elementary. She told The Room Monday night that, quote, "I am not a distraction," end quote. Earlier this year, Rome High School adopted a similar dress code. More than 1,700 people signed an online petition to protest it. We spoke to an organizer of that petition, Chloe Tilton, 15-year-old student in Rome, and she brings us this commentary.
This dress code was displayed on a PowerPoint that the principal sent to our teachers to show us. Definitely sexist the way they had it. I mean, they had a picture of a dude with his pants sagging and a hat on, but they didn't have any equivalent to the skirt. So fingertip length was unemployed. Probably about 5 inches above the knee was risk taker. Right at the knee was a go-getter. Cautious was under the knee. Traditional was mid-calf, and conservative, you're finally conservative if it's at your ankles. My name is Chloe Tilton. I'm 15 years old and I live in Rome, Georgia. It made me feel like my education wasn't as important as what I was wearing. When I walk down the halls, people are scared of getting dress coded by administrators or assistant principals when we should be focusing on our classes, and it's caused more of a disruption than dress code has in the past. And I feel like that's not fair to some of these kids that are really trying in their classes and they're not allowed to make it up because they got sent home for wearing a wrong shirt.
That was Rome High School student Chloe Tilton. Principal Eric Holland has said there are no plans to change the school's dress code or how it's imposed. A similar dress code has been proposed for Atlanta Public Schools. The issue is expected to be on the Board of Education's December meeting agenda. Just ahead, four paws and whiskers aren't always cute. We look at the problem with rats infesting Georgia cities. But first, all that glitters isn't good. We talk about Georgia's gold rush. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. When we talk about the gold rush, most people think of the thousands who ran to California to find nuggets in the water there. But Georgia had a gold rush of its own. And an exhibition at the University of Georgia features items from that 1829 event. Wright State environmental history professor Drew Swanson calls the era an ugly chapter of Georgia's past. And Drew Swanson joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
So it's kind of interesting when you read about the Georgia Gold Rush, we don't actually know what started it. I read no fewer than six or seven different accounts of the event that launched the Georgia Gold Rush, and I guess I can just pick whichever is my favorite, right?
That's probably as good a guess as any, yeah. The most famous story centers on an individual named Benjamin Parks, who... it's believed discovered gold in modern-day Lumpkin County, probably in 1828.
On his birthday.
At least according to some stories, yeah. But
just like supposedly he was just walking along a deer path and found this gigantic nugget.
That's how the story goes, that he sort of trips over this stone and probably curses it, and then when he tries to roll it back into place, he notices that it glitters, and he tries to keep the secret, but it... it leaks out, and soon North Georgia is overrun. But there are, as you said, a number of contesting claims for the first discovery in the region.
But one way or another, by the summer of 1829, the fact that there was gold in them, our hills had spread, and people began to mine gold in Georgia. It didn't last nearly as long as the California gold rush. But you say that it actually had some lasting impacts. What was one of the most important?
Well, it does. I think really the industrial story of the Georgia Gold Rush is the lasting one and the largely untold one. So, you know, Georgia school students, when they learn about the gold discovery in Georgia, they usually get this this tale of sort of rustic frontier mining, a little bit of account about how the gold rush eventually hastens the removal of the Cherokee from Georgia. And all that is somewhat accurate, but this is also a pretty industrial, commercial activity from an early date, and that persists.
And they talk about hydraulic mining and a number of blast mining, where they were literally blowing holes in the mountain to try to see if there was gold in there. Do we still see environmental impacts from more than 150 years later?
If you read the landscape, you can. So this takes multiple forms. I mean, the early mining, they're altering creek and riverbeds. They're changing the hydrology and the channels of these streams. They're using mercury as a part of the extractive process in early mining to separate gold dust from the quartz ore itself. But it's hydraulic mining, as you say, that's the really sort of intensive and destructive force at work here. So if...
can you explain what hydraulic mining is, how that works?
Yeah, so what it is it's using the pressure of water to wash away the earth and get at the ore underneath. So you would divert a river or a stream course somewhere uphill. You'd use gravity and a set of sort of narrowing pipes to increase the pressure as it flowed downhill. And the end result is essentially like turning a modern fire hose onto an embankment to wash the soil away. So if a listener has ever directed their garden hose at their yard and watched it slowly bore a hole into the earth, imagine that on a scale thousands of times larger, sort of washing away acres at a time in some cases. And that's that was pioneered in California, in some cases by Georgia miners who'd made the move when gold was discovered in California. But it's brought back to North Georgia in the late 1850s. And it's really only the Civil War that cuts those efforts short.
And there, you know, not surprisingly, there's some sort of dramatic tales. And in that particular case, the assayer in Dahlonega supposedly stood on the steps of the Dahlonega courthouse and yelled at the miners, "Why go to California? In that ridge lies more gold than man ever dreamt of." And there, he said there was millions of it. That he wasn't exactly right. They mined about 24,000 kilograms of gold. But let's move on to what happened with Cherokee land, because in many cases, miners were not concerned at all about the fact that they were mining, and in some cases, as you say, blowing holes in mountains of land that was owned by the Cherokee. What happened with the Cherokee that lived there?
Well, in many ways, this gold rush hastens Cherokee removal, as Ira mentioned, although I think it's worth noting that hastened is the best way to describe this. I think there's no real sort of genuine chance, I think, to argue that Cherokee would have remained in Georgia, wouldn't have been removed, because this happens all over the Southeast in places that gold isn't discovered. So the Choctaw and the Chickasaw are pushed out of Mississippi. The Seminole are eventually pushed out of Florida. And Georgia had been pressuring the Cherokee and the Creek, sort of gobbling up chunks of their land before gold is discovered. But it does speed it up. So you have thousands of miners flooding into Cherokee territory as soon as gold is discovered. And you have the state moving pretty quickly to establish its authority over Cherokee territory, push the federal government to hasten removal, and ultimately there's sort of a direct and pretty quick line to the Trail of Tears. But you have a few years in the 1830s where you have this sort of overlapping, contested landscape where the state has divvied up and promised these gold lots to Georgians. Cherokee still have official authority over this land, and it leads to a great deal of sort of violence and contestation on the ground.
And as you say, I want to emphasize that one of the things that you mentioned in there is that this gold rush in Georgia really may not have caused, but brought about sooner the Trail of Tears, which was a disaster of epic proportions among Native peoples. So how do we weigh the gold rush historically? Is there a way to sort of weigh the pros and cons and say it was a net positive or net negative?
Yeah, that's a complex calculation.
Yeah.
In terms of Cherokee removal, obviously, it's a tremendous negative. From the perspective of many Georgians at the time, it was a tremendous positive, right?
Yeah.
It produces a great deal of hard currency in a nation that was tremendously starved for it. Before the California Gold Rush, really the American South, Southern Appalachia, was the sole real source of gold, of specie, of hard currency. And we forget how economically important that was at the time. So about $40 million worth of gold comes from Georgia before the Civil War. That might not sound like a tremendous amount
was
to
in
us
18,
in the present, but it was. Yeah. Yes, in the 1830s and 40s. It depends on which sort of economic calculator you use, but it ranges from hundreds of millions of dollars to billions of dollars in sort of modern purchasing power.
Would there be, I mean, the Civil War kind of precipitously ended the gold rush as a rush. It didn't end the mining completely, but it pretty much ended, right? The massive numbers. So in that case, I guess the Civil War was in one very small, narrow way, a kind of a good thing, at least for the Georgia landscape, didn't really help the native peoples. But when we talk about some of the impacts that we're still feeling, especially in light of this exhibit, which looks at some of the artifacts, we also have to talk about some of the toxins that still exist, because there's a chance that the mercury left over from mining gold is still in our environment.
Yeah, some of it's floating around somewhere. As far
you don't know
as I
where
know,
it went.
There's no sort of big intensive study of this. The way that they used the mercury was they used these massive stamping machines that it would essentially pound quartz ore, break it down into smaller particles, And then that material, which contained gold dust, would be passed over these plates that contained mercury. And the mercury and the gold would bond, and then the way that you separated the two was to, using heat, boil off the mercury. So a lot of this was released into the environment. And you might imagine that as a sort of tremendous occupational health hazard, although they didn't necessarily understand it as such at the time.
Well, we understand that. In the minute that we have left, why don't we remember the Georgia Gold Rush?
I think because what happens in California overwhelms it. As important as Georgia was, and to a lesser extent, mining gold in North Carolina, the California Rush is much larger in terms of the numbers of people who become involved in the migration to undertake this mining, in terms of the gold produced. And then it'll be followed by a number of other significant large gold rushes in places like Colorado and then the Klondike, and then international rushes in Australia and South Africa.
Yeah.
And so I think there's always a sort of bigger, better gold frontier in our imagination.
That is Drew Swanson, Associate Professor of History at Wright State University. Drew, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Savannah attracts a whole lot of tourists. And if you believe the pest control experts at Terminix, an oversupply of rats. Terminix recently named Savannah the most rodent-infested city in America, overtaking Atlanta, which still has its own fair share of the furry critters. A while back, while Atlanta was still king of the rats, we invited Jason Chapman, Vice President of Sales at Peachtree Pest Control, to talk about why the city found itself home to so many rodents.
So in your own mind, how bad is Atlanta's rat problem?
It's a serious problem. We see it on a regular basis. It's something that we see every day, day in and day out. No building is exempt from it. The largest, nicest building to an abandoned building, they both can have rats.
How when you go and find a rat, I guess, infestation, is that the right word for rats?
Yep, infestation.
What's the average size of a rat infestation?
Normally on a residential side on a house, you'll have a few rats. Could be
like
up to a large family. 4 to 5, maybe up to 10. If it's a severe problem, you could have dozens. Some of the larger commercial structures could have hundreds.
What's the worst job you've gone out to and when it comes to rats?
Well, a few years ago, we did a job on a large commercial laundry. And having a large laundry, they bring in a lot of soiled towels and aprons from restaurants. So there was such a large population of rats living under the old wooden floor that it had actually burrowed some of the support beams out from underneath the building, and the floor was starting to sag. There were hundreds, potentially thousands of rats in the area because of the food source. And it took a little while to get them under control. Eventually we did. Even the workers in the laundry were standing on pallets to avoid having the rats run across their feet. So it can get out of control pretty quick, especially when that food source is there for them.
How do you, I mean, is seeing a rat the only way you know that you have one? And if you see a rat, does that let you know you have a problem?
Well, in Georgia, we've got a rat. It's called a roof rat. It's a climbing rat. It tends to go up. So the evidence that we see is oftentimes an attic or in upper spaces.
So you only hear it.
A lot of times you'll hear them. Sometimes you'll see them at night. They are mainly nocturnal, so you'll see them running around at night in the yard, on your fence, on your deck. But then again, what we see a lot of is the evidence they leave behind. Their feces, their tunnels, the damage that they do. They are rodents, so they chew everything. They have to chew to keep their teeth worn down, so everything's a fair game for them. Wiring, wood, your shingles, pieces of your house. It's amazing what they can chew.
All right. Have you seen, you talked about the worst situation you've seen in a commercial setting. What's the worst residential rat problem you've ever seen in your career?
Well, I did have a house that unfortunately the resident that was there was not able to take care of the house as well, and it was having difficulties, and the rats had gotten in. She needed a lot of help to get them taken care of because she had started feeding them to prevent them from chewing her furniture and causing more problems. That became more difficult because the rats lost their fear of people. And I actually walked into the house one day and the rats came out thinking they were getting ready to be fed. So that was an extreme case. but there were hundreds of rats in this house, and they were used to living with the person that was living there.
So if you live in New York, you just know that you're living with a lot of rats, right? Is that kind of where Atlanta is, where there's not so much that we could do to decimate the rat population, and it's more like just learn to live with them?
They're always going to be here. The green spaces that we have in Atlanta are great. We love the fact that Atlanta is a green city. But that also gives us a lot of areas that the rats can populate, that they can live in, that they can stay in. The biggest thing is to make sure that your property, whether it's your house or your business, is as unattractive as possible. Clear back the bushes, the shrubs, the tree limbs.
Help from the house.
From the house. That's the avenue that they're going to use to get into your house for the most part. The second thing is your food sources. You want to remove your bird feeders, your pet food you don't want to leave out at night. Those are both two of the biggest things that'll draw them into your structure, because they're always going to be outside.
How about getting a tabby cat?
That can work. Some cats are better catchers than others.
You're saying some cats are lazy is what you're saying.
Well, they are cats.
All right. So let's say that I'm living in my house and I hear scritchy scratchy up in my attic.
Yes.
I call you. What do I do? I set out traps. How do I...
Rats are considered pests in Georgia. They fall under pest control services, so a quality licensed exterminator should be able to handle the problem well. You want to have it inspected. You want to have somebody come in who knows what they're looking for, who can identify what's going on, maybe how long it's been there, and then the main entry and exit points that the rats are using. That way you know what's going on in your home.
Because you're there to not just get rid of the rats that are there, however many there may be, but to seal up the house so they can't get back in.
Yes. Once the rats get in, they will leave an odor behind. We may not smell it, but the other rats will, and they'll follow that odor back into a house. So if you're not sealing up the areas that they're getting into, eventually the rat population that's outside will find their way back in. A rodent can fit through the size of about a hole of a quarter. So it doesn't take much for them to sneak into a house.
And why is Atlanta's problem so bad?
I think we've got a lot of conditions. It's the climate's not bad. There's a lot of food source for them. We have a lot of green space with trees and ivy and overgrown areas. We do have Norway rats as well, which are subterranean rats. So we've got, you know, underground areas. We've got
they
sewers.
They are below and above you. The rats of Atlanta are everywhere is what Jason is saying, right?
Yeah, and they can get into anything. So they're very, very adaptable to their environment, and they're always going to be here. It's just a matter of controlling them.
That was Jason Chapman, Vice President of Sales at Peachtree Pest Control. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. If you have rat stories, you know we need to hear them, right? Let us know of any run-ins you've had with the rodents. And you know how to reach us. Call us at 404-500-9457. Find us on Facebook or on Twitter at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.